Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 42, section 6, which is old single column, page 476. All right. Now, remember the previous section, which took us quite a bit to get through, gave us a survey of the wave phenomenon relative to energy. Now we're going to get into the more specific details of the individuated phenomenon relative to energy. You have both particles and waves. They're both measures of energy, but the particles are definitively individuated, built upon that most fundamental individuation, the automaton. So when you see this section title, that's the foundational element, is automatons, building up to electrons, building up to atoms. That's the process we want to understand. And we've touched upon this quite a bit already. The thing that we haven't gotten into in any detail that they're now going to finally get to is the specific role of automatons in this phenomenon of producing matter as we experience it. How is it that it has the basic properties that we've come to understand, especially over the course of the 20th century, and we came to understand the rudimentary aspects of material phenomena. Can we take that huge pile of information and sort through it and see it in a new light? See it predicated on the objective, literal foundation of the automatons, building up through that sub-electronic domain that we've mentioned quite a few times now. You're going to see it coming into play in a more direct fashion now when we try to understand what an atom genuinely is, as opposed to how we currently attempt to rationalize it. And we won't bring it up that much. You'll see they'll occasionally refer to it. But remember, the wave phenomenon is very definitively in play in the atomic structure. So just always keep that in mind, that it's there as a space-filling phenomenon. That wave phenomena is there permeating the domain of the atom, say, that we'll be examining. But our primary focus is to really understand the individuated, the particleized phenomenon that exists within that wave field. Is the generator of that field of waves. So as we saw last time, they revealed to us that there are precisely 100 octaves of wave energy. It has this definitive twofold structure like that, an octave, and it has endpoints, a shortest wavelength and a longest wavelength. It's definitive like that, not because of the force charge. Force charge doesn't have any division or qualification in it. It's a uniform, continuous fact. That kind of specificity of manifestation, endpoints and levels, basically, that's coming from the individuality aspect that's generating those waves. There's a smallest size of a generator and a largest size of a generator and a whole structure of the generators in between. Okay, so let's look at at this, and we'll just step through this, quite slowly. I'm sure there's a number of, especially longtime readers, that have lots and lots of questions in regard to some of these issues. So let's hopefully we'll have plenty of time to flesh out this section. It would do a disservice to this section, I think, to try to do it in something else. I think this is, it's a one section evening again. All right, because there's some very significant things to understand and to clear up. All right, so let's just step our way into it.
Number 6, automatons, electrons, and atoms. While the space charge of universal force is homogeneous and undifferentiated, the organization of evolved energy into matter entails the concentration of energy into discrete masses of definite dimensions and established weight. Precise gravity reaction.
Okay, so you see, they're actually prefacing it just like I did. All right, so step one, what did we just leave behind in the previous section? That primordial force, the force charges space. Space is charged, filled with a homogeneous and undifferentiated fact. No inherent scales in it at all. Okay, it's homogeneous and undifferentiated. So if there's going to be endpoints on the 100 octaves, right, see, it has to come from the discrete masses part of the picture, as they're saying there. All right, so so the organization of evolved energy into matter, and remember how we saw that they're generalizing the word matter many times to not, so it doesn't just refer to something that literally has a mass, in a sense we understand, like the mass of a proton or whatever, or mass of a uranium atom, but to mean this individuated fact, okay, that there are discrete elements. Okay, and two things they put forward. Definite dimensions and established weight. And then they clarify the word weight. Again, they're generalizing this. They don't just mean, what happens when you're standing on a scale in a linear gravity field. They don't just mean that by weight. Okay, even though it seems like that maybe initially when they say precise gravity reaction, how much is the Earth pulling you down onto the scale? Okay, but remember, we've been, as we've gotten into this paper, we understand that when we see the word gravity, don't think just linear gravity, think more generally. Think it's an inward phenomenon in some way. The starting point with the force charge of space is a pure, homogeneous, undifferentiated outward phenomenon. Okay. So, gravity, the word gravity designates the differential from that starting point. Any inwardness at all, even a tiny bit of inwardness, doesn't have to be full on, complete, manifesting in the finite inwardness so that you get mass and linear gravity, but any inwardness, any differential inward from that outward starting point. And to think of that starting point as being quote-unquote fast, and any inwardness relative to that is slowing down. You're reining in that outwardness, bottling it up, so that a phenomenon is localized as a discrete mass. You've bottled up that outwardness back on itself so that it's a closed phenomenon in some way. All right, and then, so established weight, this idea of there's some measure of inwardness, and that's going to be related at some point to literally mass, as we understand that term at the electronic level. But the other thing they mention is definite dimensions. Okay, This inward phenomenon has two fundamental manifestations. You know, a footprint of oomph, you know, how much inwardness is there, how much is there a relationship inward to that centering influence of the aisle, and then how big a spatial footprint is involved. And they're coupled. I mean, these two things must be related. The mass of a particle must be related to the size of the particle, because it's the same phenomenon expressed in two different ways. That amount of space, you know, that space is an element of, in the motion that is that individuation. Now, that particle is a measure of motion. It's a certain unit of motion. And one of the elements of that motion is space. See, so, you know, you think about how much motion obviously is going to have something to do with this gravity reaction fact, the quote-unquote weight, but that motion involves space. So the actual spatial footprint, you know, it's just another element of the same phenomenon. And so one of the things that one eventually is going to have to figure out, if you're going to begin to put together an actual physics based upon this solid philosophic starting point that they're giving us, is what is that relationship between mass and radius of a particle? Okay. And you know, we saw the analogous thing that they gave us when they were talking about waves, that there is this definitive relationship between the radius, the size of the generator, and the wavelength of the wave that's generated. See, again, so these very definitive facts that you need to have before you have any hope of starting in some sound, in developing some sort of a sound physics. You need these basic coupling facts. How is radius coupled to mass? How is radius coupled to wavelength of the wave that's generated by the discrete mass, right? So the fact that they put that right up front, reminding you of those two things, and there's an and between them, we want to be looking for that in this section. At what point in this section do they give us the clue? You know, they must somewhere. If they don't, they haven't given us what we must have to use this revelation. So you're looking for that. Somewhere they've given a clue to that. All right. So that's the basics. Now, what about linear gravity? They make another little comment about that.
Local or linear gravity becomes fully operative with the appearance of the atomic organization of matter. Pre-atomic matter becomes slightly gravity responsive when activated by X-ray and other similar energies, but no measurable linear gravity pull is exerted on free, unattached, and uncharged electronic energy particles or on unassociated ultimatons.
Okay, so one step at a time again. All right, so what about the secondary phenomenon of this relative gravity in contrast to the absolute gravity, where you're talking about the relationship between two inward things? Okay, there's the inwardness itself, and then there's a relationship between two inwardnesses, right? That's local or linear gravity. You know, the line between those two facts, you know, is why it's linear. It's the relationship between the two. Okay, and as we figured out a long time ago, certainly definitively starting with Newton, that you need, for it to be fully in play, you know, fully operative with the appearance of the atomic organization of matter. You need to get that mass thing that we know about. Like in Newton's equation describing the magnitude of that linear gravity, one of the things you have to plug into that is the mass of each of the two objects. And so if there's no mass, there's nothing to plug in there. I mean, if one of the masses is zero, then the influence, according to that equation, is zero. Right? So in the fully operative sense, right? So we understand that part. Okay, and then, you know, as we got into the 20th century, we began to recognize what they're talking about in the second sentence there. Okay, so pre-atomic matter. So if there's something that is, you know, maybe not so fully into this finite mass footprint manifestation, pre-atomic matter becomes slightly gravity responsive. Okay, so it's not probably not going to work in Newton's equation, but there's going to be something gravity-like. Okay, and you're going, well, I wonder what they're talking about here. Okay, and then they say, you know, the clue is, when activated by X-ray and other similar energies. It's like, ah, there's that X-ray thing again that we've been seeing ever since we were in the previous paper. And they were using that as just a simple way. You know, here they even threw in other similar energies just to not be so simplistic about it, as they often have been. But you know, just to say X-ray is to point you to that oscillatory phenomenon, like we saw in the previous section, when they talked about the X-rays there, where they made a point of saying, now don't focus on a particle, photon, that's jiggling the force charge, but just think about some phenomenon that produced perturbations in the force charge. And these short wavelength waves called X-rays. Okay, so to say that, they're saying, well, what if you have an electronic level particle that's doing that wiggling back and forth sort of thing, like a wave does? What if it's stimulated in that back and forth sort of way? You know, what if it's a photon particle? You know, the photon particle is an electronic level particle. It's a collection of 100 ultimatons with some additional electronic level energy augmenting that base. And what kind of an augmentation is it? It's the kind that can be activated by an oscillatory phenomenon. You know, it's not a uniform phenomenon like an electron. You know, that just has this very constant mass and charge. There's no wiggliness to it at all. But a photon, you know, is obviously an oscillatory phenomenon. It's a little bit like this, and then it's back the other direction, then it's like, you know, back forward again, and it's going back and forth in some way. Its motion has an oscillatory nature. Like I said, at the beginning of the 20th century, we began to recognize that a photon could be coming from a distant star, for instance, and could pass close to our sun, you know, just graze the surface of the sun on its way to our telescope. And there's going to be a bending of that path. That photon, we're looking at what we received at the telescope, and if we, you know, went backward along that line and said, well, that star must be at that point, you know, extrapolated point in the sky, well, it actually isn't. It got bent around the sun a little bit. The actual star is, you know, not straight back, but back and off to the left a little bit, because the path got bent around the sun. That photon acted a little bit like it was a mass, you know, that felt some gravitational attraction, some pulls that went past the sun. And yet its mass is zero.
It is linear.
Right, this is linear gravity. Now, in a, as they're saying, slightly sense, see? You know, this is what they're talking about. You know, you can have some zero mass particles, like a photon, that will do a little bit of quasi-linear gravity sort of a thing. Okay? And we had to come up with a new theory beyond Newton's equation for gravity to rationalize that phenomenon. You know, general relativity is the theory that we have that helps us rationalize that gravitational, quote-unquote, phenomenon of a massless photon. Okay. All right, so that's what they're referring to there. It's like, okay, so there's a full mass fact, there's this sort of quasi-mass, you know. See, so in other words, this oscillation thing must be, it's like, I'm going to be mass, well, not quite. Oh, I'm going to be mass, well, not quite. I'm, you know, it must be kind of faking being a mass a little bit.
Like a schizotron. Right? A schizotron.
Right. And, you know, like I pointed out, once you get into the details of a new physics of particles, you know, you recognize that a photon is tending towards an electron, then not, and then tending towards an anti-electron, a positron, and then not. I mean, that's what it's, you know, and so the extent to which an electron has a little bit of mass, see, this that photon has a little bit of effective electron-like mass. Okay, so there's that gravitational effect of a massless particle, a photon. There's a gravitational effect of full mass, massed particles. Particles have mass. Well, what about something that doesn't have anything like that? Okay, and that's what they're pointing out at the end there. Okay, but no measurable linear gravity pull is exerted on free. Okay, and you know, they're going to say uncharged. You know, all the photons uncharged. Okay, but you don't want it, you know, in association with anything like going near a star or something like that. So just out there all by itself, free. Okay, so no measurable linear gravity pull is exerted on free, unattached. Okay, so it can't be in association with an atom, say. You know, if we're going to have something that doesn't have a charge, it has, you know, can't be near anything. It can't be literally, you know, kind of incorporated into something. You know, like we've been talking about sub-electronic stuff being incorporated into an atom. Okay, that wouldn't be unattached. Okay, so unattached and uncharged. You know, so it can't have any of that kind of motion phenomenon that we describe by that word electric charge. Okay, and you know, this electronic energy particle, so they're talking about anything in the electronic level, not just an electron, but any of those basic particles in the electronic level, or on unassociated ultimatons, like 100 ultimatons being associated into an electronic level particle. Now, no, that's associated. That wouldn't be unassociated ultimatons. So everything from just a free ultimaton to all of those free subelectronic particles, all the way up to certain electronic level particles that have no charge, you know, or even kind of a quasi-charge thing or, you know, whatnot happening, those kind of particles have no linear gravity phenomenon, not even in the general relativity rationalization sort of sense, you know, nothing at all. An ultimaton, you know, doesn't feel anything like that. An ultimaton can go right by a, you know, a star and doesn't get bent or anything like that. Okay, it's not feeling any sort of a linear gravity phenomenon. Yeah.
So if you had a subatomic particle, uh-huh, could that be 10 ultimatons? Because, you know, which we don't necessarily know, but I mean, could it be 10, so to speak, because they don't come together?
We'll get to that. That's in a couple of, it's in a few paragraphs, but right. So yeah, it's just one step at a time. See, so first of all, the ultimaton, okay, and then let's say there's a collection of 10. I mean, obviously we don't know much about the sub-electronic domain. Let's assume maybe you can have a construct of 10, okay? That would not have any linear gravity phenomenon either in the free, unattached context. It's going to be just a purely massless, linear gravity-less phenomenon. It's going to travel in straight lines. Okay, so all the way up Yep. Go ahead, Gene.
Why does it have to travel or move? Why can't it be stationary?
Couple two.
Oh, well, okay. I mean, when I'm saying it's moving in a straight line, I mean, you know, it has no independent motion of its own. It's a, like a marker dot on the force charge. It's, you know, and so you're just seeing, you know, the outward motion of the force charge. You know, when you see an ultimaton go whizzing by you, it's not whizzing. The force charge that it's glued to is whizzing by. You know, it allows you to see the motion that is the force charge. Okay. Same way with a photon. I mean, all the way up to a photon, I mean, it moves at the speed of light. That speed is the speed of the force charge. It has no independent motion of its own. It just moves outward with the force charge. Dump a pile of photons, you know, at a location, and they all go outward, okay, from that point. You know, they don't ball up into a sphere. You know, there's no inwardness there. It's pure outwardness. They go outward at the speed of light. Okay? Ultimatons move at the speed of light. Subelectronic particles move at the speed of light. Everything moves at the speed of light because the speed of light is the speed of the force charge. It's not actually the speed of light. It's just, see, the light is the only thing we know so far that, you know, directly is showing you that force charge motion. Okay? With one exception. Okay. Just as the revelation was, you know, was being given to us, we were beginning to recognize one other uncharged electronic level particle, a neutrino. Okay, a neutrino, and initially what we were discovering is what's now called an electron neutrino. We now also have muon and tauon neutrinos. We have three different neutrinos. The important ones are the electron and the muon neutrinos. One's related to electrons and one's related to what are called heavy electrons, muons. Okay. Those are uncharged. And until the rationalization scheme recently got really off in the woods and astray, everyone recognized neutrinos as being massless, as they're describing here. Okay. Neutrinos, despite what you'll hear someone say now in the current rationalization scheme, a neutrino is a massless particle. It's an uncharged, no linear gravity-like thing particle. That's one of the things they're talking about here. So a free neutrino doesn't show any linear gravity phenomenon.
But it must be made up of ultimatons, right?
Yes, it is. Okay. A neutrino is a collection of 100 ultimatons with a little bit of, you know, of electronic level motion added to it. I mean, every electronic level particle is a collection of 100 ultimatons as a base.
So it's not a subelectronic particle?
No, it's not a subelectron. It's an electronic level particle. It's rubbing shoulders or, you know, butting elbows with all the other electronic level particles. You know, electrons and neutrinos, you know, have give and take, and protons and neutrons and neutrinos have give and take. I mean, it's in there in the mix with them, just like photons are. You know, a photon can interact with a proton. You know. You're on that level. Everything is at that eye level of the electronic level, and they're butting against each other in various ways. Okay. Now, you know, so that's definitely neutrinos are another example. If they're in there in some free, unattached sense, they're definitely uncharged electronic energy particles. So they're not doing any linear gravity. And the one other important particle that current science has no concept of is the electronic level base itself. All over in this room are these electronic level bases, a collection of 100 ultimatons with nothing augmenting that base. It's just the foundation. It doesn't have any photon-like addition. It doesn't have any neutrino-like addition. It doesn't have any sort of an addition to it. You know, certainly not any sort of a proton-like addition. It's just the base.
No charge. It's
no charge, no mass, no nothing.
It's just there.
Right? It's just the base. And see, because it has zero electronic level energy, I mean, it's the starting point. It's what you add to get some measure of electronic level energy. And since all we understand in current science is electronic level phenomena, we obviously have no place for zero. I mean, you know, for us, something that has zero electronic level energy is a nothing. Okay, but it's definitely a something. It's a collection of 100 ultimatons, and it does engage. I mean, it's the foundation of that electronic level interaction. These particles that, you know, interact with each other, sometimes they interact with those electronic level bases. And because we don't know of their existence, we have a fundamentally illogical picture. You know, if we are watching a particle that has charge or mass, so we can, you know, measure it, observe it in some way, chugging along, and all of a sudden it becomes two particles, you know, we just make sure that the momentum and energy all balance and we're happy. Well, but objectively, there's an issue there. I've got one particle chugging along, that's 100 ultimatons. And then I've got two particles chugging along, that's 200 ultimatons. Where do the other 100 ultimatons come from? Okay, just because I balance the electronic level energy, you know, I'm missing the details below the electronic level. Below the electronic level.
They're all
right. See, what actually happened is an electronic level base and that particle I was observing collided. Some of the electronic level energy on the one I was observing switched over to the one I didn't know was there. And then now they both have some electronic level energy, so I can measure them and I see the two leave. Okay? That's what actually is happening. And that simple fact, okay, that you've got this particle that doesn't have any sort of gravitational manifestation, doesn't have any charge, you know, manifestation, nothing. But it's there, objectively it's there, and colliding. If you just add in that one simple fact, a whole bunch of rationalization scheme disappears in the current standard model.
Makes sense.
Okay. People have won Nobel Prizes for the rationalization to make up for the fact that you aren't including the objective fact of that invisible particle. You know, it's invisible from an electronic level point of view. If you could see ultimatons, it wouldn't be invisible. It's this great big honking collection of 100 of them cruising along, okay?
Chris, would that be a precursor to an electron?
Right. It's the precursor to all particles.
A base.
I take that base. So I'm using the word base. It's the base. It's the foundation. Just like the foundation of a house is the precursor to the walls of the house.
Okay.
The walls. Well, no. It's the base of the electronic. Okay. Subelectronic means you have less than 100 ultimatons.
Right.
It's 100 ultimatons. It's the bottom floor of the 100 ultimaton domain, the electronic level regime. Okay? And I add some things on that base and I have a proton. I add some things on that base, I have an electron. I add some things on that base, I have a neutrino. I add some things on that base, I have a uranium nucleus.
So if you could see it, you could see it, but you can't measure it.
I can't measure it when my measuring devices are either measuring mass or charge.
But okay. If your eyes could see the ultimaton, you would be able to
see it. Right. You could certainly see a collection of 100 of them and all of the super additive consequence of that collection of 100. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
You just revised.
Let me do this question here first then. Okay.
And we also have no cause for, the one guy chugging along and apparently splitting into two, right? That appears to us to be a causeless.
Right. So we just rationalize it, you know, as some sort of an internal instability. Yeah, but it's not. It's an environmental, you know, it's an external whacking that caused that change, not an internal, you know, for no causal reason unraveling.
But wouldn't, doesn't everything do that? I mean, wouldn't everything be internally unstable by that? Or
Remember we did the, you know, they reminded us, let's see, where was that? The going concern line, wherever the heck that was. Can't remember where that is now. Remember, everything is quantized, you know, for a reason, because there's an environment that everything is sitting in. If everything was sitting in nothing, you know, in the midst of nothing, a vacuum, you know, it could be feather delicate and not have any issue. But it's nothing is sitting in such a gentle environment. Everything is sitting in a very aggressive environment. And so everything is definitively quantized so that it can withstand this assault. Your body is being peppered by, you know, gazillions of those things every second. You know, and yet you're not being chipped away.
Now speak for
yourself.
Okay? Yeah. So electrons do go through human bodies?
No. An electron is not going to pass through your body because it's got a charge. It interacts very aggressively with matter in your body.
Okay. An automaton can...
But an automaton, right, could go right through your body.
Okay.
Just like an electron neutrino goes right through your body. I mean, right now, there's so many electron neutrinos going through my fingernail right now, you couldn't even begin to imagine, you know, and they're passing right through my fingernail like it's not even there. They're passing right through the earth like it's not even here, okay? They don't, because they don't have a charge, they don't interact very much, okay? And they just go sailing right through. It's very hard to detect an electron neutrino. To get something just so that will, get impacted, rather than it just passing by. And it took us quite a while before we developed detectors to actually detect neutrinos. Yeah, well, we have them now. Yep.
Could angels or other, bad celestial beings or something misuse this or use these to our detriment? Is this something we need to worry about?
Okay, well, I mean, when we're talking about, take a seraphim, that kind of angel. They are stationed on a world. Okay, they're not floating near a world. You know, they're on a world. They walk on it. Okay, their feet meet resistance to something. Now, they're not going to feel the molecular nature of the planet or the atomic nature, but they are going to feel at least the ultimatonic. There's going to be some relationship between the energy of their body, which has some physical energy in it. They're not purely spirit substance. The only beings that have bodies of purely spirit substance are those ones that the revelators don't even understand on the eternal sun's worlds. I mean, divine counselors and the seraphim and everyone else has some physical energy in their body, so that they're logically individuated, physical energy is the individuality substance, whereas spirit is the unity substance. So beings do have a relationship to the very fundamental levels of material phenomena, so that they can be on a world. And you take a being like a midwayer, especially a secondary midwayer, they have, some degree of power being nature. They have some very definitive ability to take a hold of the physical energy nature of something, whether or not they, at what level do they engage it? Like if they're going to roll the stone away, in Jesus' tomb, do they grab it molecularly it's kind of hard to imagine they do if they didn't make themselves visible. They're probably not engaging it atomically or molecularly. They're probably engaging it, you know, at a more fundamental level, somehow locking onto it as an ultimatonic phenomenon, you know, and manipulating it, just like the power beings do. So, yes, I mean, back, remember, many strange things, you know, happened, you know, prior to Pentecost and, you know, all of the rebels being taken off, especially the rebel secondary midwares, you know, if they were bored, they could do all kinds of things, you know, and so no wonder there's all sorts of weird stories in our mythology, you know, of angels, quote unquote, or spirit beings, or, you know, quote unquote, doing something weird. There probably were a number of very strange things that those bored, you know, for millennia, rebel secondary midwayers did. You know, who knows mischief. What they did? Mischief. All kinds of mischief. You know, and so not just playing with inanimate things, but animate things too. You know, and because they not only have that ability to engage the physical energy with this power being-like nature, but they can engage creatures, animals, mindily, too, and manipulate animals. You know, because animals don't have spirit force fields up. You know, that would block that. So, you know, if they want to make, you know, an animal, you know, run circles, you know, they could have done it. They just grab a hold of its mind and make it run in circles. So, yeah, all kinds of weird things. But, you know, the loyal midwayers are not bored. Yeah, and they're loyal. So there isn't foolishness like that going on. But they could do it, theoretically. Okay, all right, but see, what we're worried about here is just the basic issue of, if we have these uncharged, you know, the basic thing is that it's uncharged, you know, I mean, sub-electronic particles, ultimatons, they're uncharged, yeah. If you have an uncharged particle, it's not going to have any overt mass-like footprint to it. Okay, even an effective, you know, tiny one like an electron does. Okay, and so you know they want to make sure you appreciate that as you go forward thinking about what they're going to say. That when you're thinking about trying to understand the actual nature of an atom. How it involves sub-electronic energies you know, as we've been, you know, seeing them touch upon over and over again here, you have this kind of basic non-mass aspect to that. It's not like you're adding a billiard ball to the atom when you're adding this sub-electronic stuff. You're not going to get a definitive glob of mass sort of augmentation of the phenomenon. You know, like you can certainly observe, you know, adding an electron to an atom, and sure enough, the mass of the atom is the amount greater that is the mass of an electron. Right? I mean, you just add this little billiard ball thing, and the mass goes up by that amount of billiard ball mass phenomena, you know, manifestation. But we could be doing things that aren't so definitively mass-like, but they're going to be attached. They're going to be involved in the energy phenomenon of the atom. So something that in some ways you might appreciate the existence of in an energetic sense, but not in a simplistic mass-like billiard ball sense. See, obviously we're going to try to move away from rationalizing the atom with the billiard ball model. I mean, it has its place. It gets us a lot of, you know, it's allowed us to build all this technology in the room here, you know, the billiard ball rationalization of the atom. But to go the rest of the way with understanding the atom, we need to let go of trying to rationalize it purely with little nuggets of mass. Okay? It's not a universe of mass, it's a universe of motion. Some motion manifests as mass, but not all motion. Yeah. Especially subelectronic, you know, is fundamentally motion that's not manifesting in a mass-like way, in any sort of linear gravity-like way. Okay, but it's motion nonetheless. All right. I think we got everything there, didn't we? It was that one little thing. We were talking about the electronic level base. Yeah, just, the fact that it just so, like you were saying, about the causality. I mean, that's the magnificent thing about recognizing that there's these electronic level bases in the environment, in the mix in our physics experiments, you know, that they're playing a role, is so many things that are currently acausal. You know, they happen just 'cause. We describe what we observe, the how of the phenomenon, but we have no way of understanding it causally. You know, we call it particle decay. Just particles going along and it just decays. It just falls apart. No, there was a cause to that behind that effect. You're observing an effect, and it's not a causeless effect. It was caused by an impact. There was a collision between the particle you observed and one you didn't. You know, that chargeless, massless electronic base.
Okay, and so why we're falling apart.
Humans are falling apart as they get old, not because they're being assaulted by the subelectronic environment or something, but because the life animation that's been engaged to your matter is losing its grip.
Decaying.
Right? That interface, there's nothing innately animated about physical energy. It has to be animated. It's not like spirit substance that's, you know, self-animating. The animation is in the spirit substance. There's no animation in physical substance. Life animation has to be added to that. There's an interface there. And where there's an interface, there's a potential for a degrading interface. Right? There's nothing eternal about that interface. So, you know, with time, you know, the linkage, you know, diminishes. That's what causes, fundamentally what causes aging. All right. So let's get to the next thing here.
Automatons function by mutual attraction, responding only to the circular paradise gravity pull. Without linear gravity response, they are thus held in the universal space drift. Automatons are capable of accelerating revolutionary velocity to the point of partial anti-gravity behavior, but they cannot, independent of force organizers or power directors, attain the critical escape velocity of de-individuation, return to the puissant energy stage. In nature, automatons escape the status of physical existence only when participating in the terminal disruption of a cooled off and dying sun.
A whole bunch of things in that paragraph. So let's, again, step it through one at a time. Okay, so automatons function by mutual attraction. Down the ways a bit, you know, we'll get the huddling proclivity comment. So you have this observed fact. It's deeply mysterious even for the relators, but this observed fact that automatons come together. They don't come together because they're masses, and masses gravitate towards one another, and there's nothing linear gravity about that. And it's not even the kind of attraction like with the photon, where the photon was showing signs of attraction to the sun. Okay? This is a mutual attraction. It's just one automaton to another automaton. Okay, and why is it mysterious to them? Because it's happening in a purely absentite domain where they have no way to get at the mechanics of it, understand it. But philosophically, you can understand why there could be mutual attraction. An automaton is that smallest measure of inwardness, differentiation relative to the outwardness of the force charge. I mean, it is some degree of inwardness by definition, or it would be the force charge, right? You know, so two of them are in some way, some little wisp relative to the finite of inwardness. So obviously they could somehow, have an association potential, right? But that, that relationship is transcendent and hence not open to observation. It's like the iceberg analogy. You're watching the tips of the icebergs that are above the water, come towards each other, but you don't see that there's a great big nuclear powered motor underneath the water attached to the foundations of those two icebergs, driving them towards each other. So you can't see the causality. It's a transcendent causality, but it's obviously a causality. Everything's causal. All you see is these automatons pool together in some way.
So you say that even these revelers don't understand it, but they understand what you understand.
Right. They understand the philosophic fact. They don't understand the science because the science is not open to observation. It's not finite science.
Right. They understand it's an absentite thing, right?
Right. They understand it's an absentite thing. Yeah.
They just haven't gotten that far. This guy's a mighty messenger, so he's probably in the core, right?
Right. Still finite beings, and right. I mean, none of these revelators are absentite beings. They don't have any direct understanding of.
They
understand it logically, but not directly.
Experientially.
Right. They don't have no direct experience with the absentite. None of us will until we all do. When the grand universe transcends the finite.
Then it won't be special.
Right. And then it'll just be run of the mill, everyday sort of stuff. Right?
I always knew that.
Okay, so this mutual attraction brings them together. Responding only to the circular paradise gravity pull, that inwardness. The automaton has is a sphere. It has a radius, right? And it has a circularness to it.
That's why they
should say spherical.
Well, I mean, they're contrasting the difference between linear and circular.
That's what's revolutionary.
Well, the revolutionary is another issue. I mean, that's a separate issue. But just the fact that it manifests the centering influence of the aisle gives it this circularity, a circularity in every direction. Right? Now, maybe it is just, in the absentite, it's just circular. But see, when you manifest a two-dimensional circle that's in the absentite down into the finite, it'll manifest as a sphere, because that two-dimensional circle projects into every circle in the finite, and so it would manifest spherically. Okay, and if it was a two-dimensional thing, then it would be easier to understand it as an axial revolution, with an equator. Right, but we're just speculating here. Okay, but you can see possibility for eventually understanding these phenomena. Right, so there's no linear gravity, like we talked about in the previous paragraph. So all you're going to see with it, in terms of something besides the mutual attraction phenomenon, is, the automatons will drift around the flows in the various levels. They will be drifting counterclockwise in the super universe level, clockwise in the first outer space level, counterclockwise in the second outer space level. I mean, they're going to be following that drift that everything is. They're locked on the force charge, and the force charge is, is drifting. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so they, you know, they do that. But it's important to remember, you know, when they say circular gravity, don't think around the center of all things. Don't think around the elliptical path. I mean, just think the fact that it's a little spherical manifestation. Okay.
Kind of like there's outwardness everywhere, except that one point. Yeah. There's a little inwardness.
There's this inwardness no matter which way you go on a circumference of a circle. You know, whereas linear gravity, there's no circularness. You know, I mean, it's just along a line, right? It's between two points. The inwardness is along a line rather than the inwardness, you know, along the circumference of a circle. Okay. All right. Right, the centering influence, the Isle of Paradise, right? That's what they mean. Automatons, okay, are capable of accelerating revolutionary velocity to the point of partial anti-gravity behavior. Okay, what do they mean by that? They're going to, in the next paragraph, they're going to talk about that axial revolution, and then they'll give us some more details about it. The point here is that as I build up from a hydrogen atom, up to fermium, element number 100. So I go from element 1 to element 100. I'm increasing the magnitude of this revolutionary velocity. We mentioned that before when they were talking about the temperature, velocity, and revolution affect this. Remember when we talked about those three? Perhaps. Now here they're bringing up the velocity part again. Just that magnitude of going from minimum velocity in this sense to maximum at element 100. And what happens, you know, so if you keep building up like that, if you go past element 100, the thing unravels. It does a partial anti-gravity behavior. See, that element 100 is element 100, a particular atom of it, a little nugget of inwardness, because there's inwardness. Now, if I finally build up an outwardness that negates that inwardness, then, see, the anti-gravity is outwardness relative to inwardness. You know, it's going to come apart. Right? See, so that's what happens. You get up to 100. If you try to, you know, augment that, there's not net inwardness, and the thing comes apart. You need net inwardness. Okay? See, so that's what's happening. You're adding outwardness and outwardness until finally the net goes outward.
That's why those more than 100 don't last very long.
Right. So if you when we make ones bigger than 100, right, they last for just a fraction of a second, right? Because they're fundamentally unstable. They're fundamentally net outward, not inward. So they're not going to sit there. Yeah. You can build one, and you know, and it's there for a split second, and then you know, apart it comes. Okay, so that's what they mean by partial anti-gravity. I mean, it's just in that, see, that net sense. It's not like automatons evaporate. Okay, it's just this construct. You know, has a, you know, so it's partial anti-gravity, and see, and then they explain that. See, but it's not the full sense of, but they cannot, independent of force organizers or power directors, attain the critical escape velocity of de-individuation. Return to the puissant energy stage. Right, when we went from puissant energy to automatons, when you're thinking about going from the whirl and the force charge, you know, condensing into automatons, that's going from the absonite to the finite. Okay. This whole revolutionary axial revolution phenomenon of an automaton and associations of it, super additive consequences of it, and that's all finite phenomena. So it doesn't matter how grandiose it is, it's not going to transcend the finite. Okay? So automatons are not going to get de-individuated. The only way for that to happen, you know, like they're saying, artificially, you could imagine it happening. Power beings could take a finite physical structure and unravel it down to the automatons, you know, like those secondary dissociators, for instance. You know, okay, so they could unravel it down to the automatons, and then the force organizers could grab a hold of the automatons, the associate ones, and de-individuate them back into puissant energy. Right. So the power directors and the force organizers could do this, but no finite process is going to do that. Yeah. And the real key is the absentite beings, the force organizers. They're the ones that can take it across the threshold from a finite into an absentite. Okay. And vice versa. Yeah, and de-individuate it. Its individuation is a finite phenomenon. Yeah.
So a force organizer couldn't do that with matter that's still in structures. It has to be unraveled.
Right. The only thing that an associate transcendental master force organizer can grab a hold of is an automaton. Can't grab a hold of...
But it can't grab a hold of automatons while they're in structures. It can only grab hold of...
Well, I mean, think about it like this. If you do the top-down thing where the absentite is above and the finite is below as you're in your picturization, that atomic, say, or molecular phenomenon is way down below the boundary between the finite and the absentite. Those associate force organizers can only touch the boundary. They can't dip their fingers down in. See, so it's like, well, yeah, but there's automatons in there. So, I mean, you got to, in order to, you know, I mean, obviously we're trying to create an analogy here to picture it, you know, and understand it in some way. You got to think that those automatons are not accessible. There's, you know, a casing around them, you know, that's down in the finite, right? I guess would be the way you would have to understand it, why, you know, why they have both of them in the list there, if, you know, right? Okay. Question. Okay.
Does the finite become the absentite, and then there's no more finite? Wouldn't there always be finite stuff? Is that associate of finite in quiescent energy always going to have finite stuff to work with in an absentite era in the future days?
Right. No. Right. The way that works. I mean, you can use the same analogy I was just using, but you know, in a reciprocal sense. Right now, finite beings can experience finite phenomena. In the next universe age, no one will be able to experience any finite thing. Most straightforwardly, because there's no finite beings to have finite experiences. But you know, more fundamentally. You know, why can't anyone get at the finiteness to experience it anymore? It's because it's bottled up inside. Now there's an absentite casing around it, you know, and all you can touch is the absentite. You can't get inside to have finite experiences anymore. Right? I mean, that's the most straightforward way to understand, you know, what will be going on in the next universe age. And how fundamental that is. Like, one of the things I'm experiencing in this room right now is a certain finite distance between my eyes and one of you. That won't be experienceable in the next universe age. You won't be able to experience finite distances or finite angles. You know, like, you know, 15 degrees or something. There is no... See, so the separation between things in the absentite ages, see, it's not the kind of separation we're used to. None of this finite, all of these finite separations will go to zero. Right? And hence they're not experienceable, see? Because they have no extent. Right? The distance between two beings will not be the kind of distance, you know, between the first outer space level and the second outer space level. That distance will be zero in the absentite age.
Really?
Yes, that's a finite distance. But there will be a first and second outer space level separated by an absentite separation. The finite separation will not be experienceable anymore. See, you got to understand the geometry. You know, you go through Havona right now and you experience finite separation between worlds, say, you know, when you're ascending through there. And after the grand universe settled in light and life, and everything's absentite, no one will ever be able to experience the finite distances between Havona worlds again. You know, you'll experience the absentite geometry of the central universe, not the finite geometry, which is that pancake thing, you know, with strings of pearls. That geometry won't exist anymore.
What about the seven superuniverses?
Same thing. See, you know, there will be separation amongst all things, but no finite separation. See, again, you got to remember, we think of the finite separation between us as an absolute. A little over-aggrandizing it. Yeah, there's nothing absolute about the distance between these two beings sitting on couches here. This is a finite separation, and I can transcend that finite separation.
Would absolute be even different than absinite?
Yeah. I mean, there is an absolute separation of things that's even transcendent of the absinite separations of things. Right? In the cosmos infinite, you know, as co-absolute beings, everyone will be experiencing the trans-absinite separation between things. See, this is why it's so important that you have an absolute dimension to your personality. If you didn't, eventually our two personalities would blur together as we keep going to higher and higher levels of transcendence. There's got to be a way to keep them separated. If they just had three finite dimensions and that's it, you know, when the grand universe is settled in light and life, every finite being would pool into one being. You'd lose all those personalities.
Spirit beings, by
then? Right, it doesn't matter how spirit being, you're going to be a lot fancier than spirit being when you're a seven-stage spirit. You're going to be an absinite being, not just merely spiritual. But again, you'll transcend all finite spirit. You know, your wildest imagination of this transcendent thing called spirit, you're going to transcend on me. You know, you're going to transcend the greatest thing you can imagine about spirit right now, which is just a seventh super universe type spirit. You're going to transcend that when you go into Havona.
That in love is the picture of personality encompassment as individuation.
I mean, you got to understand, all the finite dimensionality of our personalities will be transcended. And that'll all be bottled up inside of us. That finite dimensionality won't manifest anymore in the absinite ages. It will be, what's eventuated inside of you.
So the experience that we're going through, and they say, these guys are, you guys are going to make great administrators, that kind of thing. Well, but our experience for doing that is all going to be in the finite.
Right.
So how are we going to take the finite experience into the absolute?
Just the way I just said it. The totality of finite eventuates. A partial finite can't be taken into the absinite ages, but a totality of finiteness can. That's what the word eventually means. Eventually all the partial evolutionary has a completeness. You can put a bow around it and have it be bottled up inside of an absinite being.
So all your experiences will be
as a finite whole will be inside of you. You'll use the wholeness. See, that wholeness of your finite will be the starting point of your absinite manifestation.
So that's why they say a half-hearted effort is unavailing.
Right, because it can't get to eternity. It can't even get to the boundary between the finite and the absinite. Right? You can't cross that boundary. Right? This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected to each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole.
Everything.
The only way to get to eternity, is to be able to have a wholeness of finiteness that can transcend that boundary into absiniteness, let alone whatever the heck it needs to get all the way to eternity. But, I mean, it can't even get to time transcending if it isn't whole-like. Right? So, if your prayer is not whole-like, is it going to make it all the way to eternity? No, it's not even going to make it out of the finite. It has no way to get there. Right? So that's why we're so dependent upon having a measure of wholeness by grace so that we can just do some of these things, like have a personality get connected to us. I mean, because these things that come from such a transcendent domain are not going to engage some partiality. you have to be given a thread of wholeness by grace. That's that initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit that you're given by grace. So eternity can get to you. Now your job is to take note of that and do the reciprocal in kind, yeah, from now to eternity. Yeah. All right. Got to keep going here. We're going to run out of time.
I didn't think we'd get through this.
Okay. All right. Okay, so then that last little bit is a fun little tidbit that they throw in here because they've got a great opportunity to do it in context. So in nature, automatons escape the status of physical existence only when participating in the terminal disruption of a cooled off and dying sun. And what are they talking about? They're talking about a supernova, you know, that type of supernova. And how does that work? Remember, we talked about that. You know, if everything, you know, if it, the support is lost and the thing collapses on itself, you have this inward, you know, phenomenon where things are getting crushed and crushed until finally it gets to the point where you've got nothing but automatons. You've crushed all of the bigger structures, you know, and ground them into pure automatons, and it's still collapsing, and it's going to try to crush those automatons out of existence. Okay, but it can't. Okay? But it's going to do, it's going to enter that infra-ultimatonic domain that we read about last time. Okay, they'll start to de-individuate. There'll be just a little bit of de-individuation. See, you know, that's what they're saying. The automatons escape the status of physical existence, okay, only when. Okay, there's a little bit of momentary de-individuation, not fully, back to puissant energy, but just that little boundary layer between the finite and the absent, the infra-ultimatonic, okay, and then it hits bottom and rebounds off of it, right? See, so the ultimatons start to unravel, and they have, like, you know, from a finite perspective, infinite tension, you know, and they snap back, and everything flies out, you know, off of that rebound, and that's the supernova explosion. Okay. And so not only are you going to have infra-ultimatonic rays being generated when force organizers are making ultimatons, but a supernova is going to produce, now that kind of supernova is going to produce a whole bunch of infra-ultimatonic rays. Yeah, that last, you know, rock bottom point, it's going to jiggle the force charge at that very, very tiny scale. And all these infra-ultimatonic rays are going to go flying off from that supernova location. Okay, so that's what they're referring to there.
Do they ever really have an occasion to reverse automatons back into puissant anyway?
I have no idea.
This yeah. doesn't do that.
Yeah, I mean.
Would they ever need to? I mean, I don't know why you would.
Yeah, I mean.
Force charges.
I mean, it's hard to imagine that the master architects and the force organizers and these transcendental beings, you know, go, oh, so we shouldn't have made that automaton. Okay, let's back that one up. They probably have the big picture in mind and, you know, don't have to reverse this, would be my guess.
Isn't really allowed reverse. Like, you're reversing something. Well, that never happens.
Yep. All right. Okay, let's get to the next one here.
The automatons, unknown on Urantia, slow down through many phases of physical activity before they attain the revolutionary energy prerequisites to electronic organization. Automatons have three varieties of motion: mutual resistance to cosmic force, individual revolutions of anti-gravity potential, and the intra-electronic positions of the 100 mutually interassociated automatons.
Okay. So there it finally is. Remember I pointed to this fact a while back that we'd be coming up on the threefold nature of automatons. So here it is finally. All right, so the precursors, just, you know, I already explained that idea of quote-unquote slowing down. So, you know, going inward from the starting point of outwardness. And notice how they're saying through many phases of physical activity. So, You know, reminding you again, I mean, it doesn't say through a phase. I mean, it says through many phases. So this sub-electronic regime is complex. There's apparently all kinds of detail in it, you know, like maybe 10 automatons, 20 or whatever. But there's many phases. So it's it has quantization to it, if you will. It has specificity in it. And then, you know, the really definitive fact. So everything is made out of automatons. It's like, well, what properties do automatons have? Well, they have three properties, and they're all three motions. Okay. It should be pretty definitive at that point that it's a universe of motion, period. Right? The only properties are motion properties. I mean, that's all there is. So look at these three motions that an automaton is manifesting. One called mutual resistance to cosmic force. Well, I've alluded to that the force charge pushes on the automaton, and the automaton pushes on the force charge. They stay coupled in some way. Okay, now this mutual resistance, am I supposed to think of that in static terms, where, you know, you got the two just, you know, pushing at each other, you know, locked against, you know, heads against each other, butting heads? No, it's a motion, it says. So somehow that's a motion. Well, if I'm going to think of it coupling, and it's going to somehow be a motion, if I could, you know, understand this level of motion, I'm going to have to think of it as a dynamic coupling. Okay. So your first thought in being able to express this coupling to the force charge in some physics equation, I want some kind of dynamic coupling. So, like, if I coupled the momentums, like the momentum of the particle coupled to the momentum of the wave, that the two are equal. You know, the momentum of the wave pushing on the particle is equal to the momentum of the particle pushing on the wave. They're dynamically coupled. You know, momentum, you know, in a simple electronic level sense, is mass times velocity. See, so it has a dynamic aspect to it. All right, see, so that's the idea there. Is, you know, you're going to look for phenomena in physics that are related to that coupling. They mentioned it in the previous, at the end of the previous section. You know, just like a boat going across the water leaves, you know, waves on the surface, right? A particle, like an electron, going along produces waves. Hence, you can make electron microscopes. That's because of that motion, that coupling to the force charge. You know, property number one. Okay, property number two, individual revolutions of anti-gravity potential. Right? So they have this axial revolution. You know, obviously, it's somehow related to the fundamental individuation that they are. You know, the closed back on itself nature that is this individuation. You know, so that, you know, that's the property sort of in and of themselves. The first property was how that couples to the force charge. And they're, like we mentioned, anti-gravity potential, because you're going to, you know, have greater and greater velocity of this axial revolution, and it can eventually produce a net outwardness of the atom, and it unravels. Okay, and then the third motion is the intra-electronic positions of the 100 mutually inter-associated automatons. Okay, we had that mutual attraction thing producing the mutually inter-associated automatons. But, you know, how am I supposed to think about this collection of 100 automatons? Is it like a little crystal lattice, you know, where it's static? No. Even though I'm going to call them quote-unquote positions, they're not static positions. You know, those positions are motions. It's like, okay, I can't picture that. Of course we can't. You know, we're getting to very transcendent things to picture, but just make sure that you, whatever you do, don't think of that collection of 100 automatons as 100 little marbles glued in some, you know, beautiful little pattern. Okay, and there is no such thing. Okay. Yep.
Is mind finite or absent?
finite mind is finite and absentite mind is absentite. It's a simple answer to that question. Right, I mean, we all are using finite expressions of mind.
Go back to what you were saying again.
Okay, so, all right, so, you know, they're pointing out that there's, you know, there's some sort of an arrangement, but we don't want to think of it as a static spatial arrangement. There's some sort of coordination of motions. In some way, you know, these little units of motion, an automaton, are in association. And since we literally have a collection of 100, rather than saying super additive, we probably ought to say super summative in this case, to just kind of stress the fact that we don't just have two things that are super additive. You know, we're talking about each of them as a unit of motion, and then there's this whole super summative motion that has to do with their association. And there's relativity to this, so that there's quote-unquote positions. See, that's what they mean by positions. There's some sort of relativity of this association. There isn't just one way that they're associated. This is a variable phenomenon, okay? Okay, and it's this whole supersummative fact. So there's the individual motion, there's the supersummative motion, and then there's a coupling of the motion to the motion that is the force charge. Those are the three, you know, see, and that coupling is a motion. You know, that's kind of a super additive. Okay? You know, that relationship produces a super additive motion. See, there's these three different motions. Okay, and that should be quite mysterious. Okay, but the important thing is just to let go of any static picture. You know, we let go of the static ether in the previous section. Right, now let go of any static things, particles. Everything is a motion. Yeah. All right, something here?
Yeah, so shouldn't it be, why do they say intra-electronic positions, wouldn't it be intra-sub-electronic positions?
Well, no. Within the electronic level particle.
Intra-electronic.
Intra-particles, you know. Okay. Not, you know, inter-particle, but intra-part. Yeah, so, you know, like we said, I mean, most of the time, the particleness that you're interested in is the collection of 100 ultimatons. And there's what's outside of that and what's inside of that. All right. Yeah. Oh, you got something too?
Well, it's kind of an abstract question, but you know, it talks a little bit later on about how they cluster it on whatever they get together as 100 in different ways, so to speak.
Right. We're just about to read that. Yeah.
Behind that.
I think what?
Is there something that is even deeper than that, that's causing their, you know, how they cluster or how they react to one another, how they get together, or, you know, when they, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, okay. Yeah, and we'll speak to that here as we, okay. Yeah, in the next few paragraphs. Okay. All right, it's not an amorphous phenomenon. It's a very much pattern-rich phenomenon, right? And so we need to address that, yes. Okay.
Mutual attraction holds 100 ultimatons together in the constitution of the electron, and there are never more nor less than 100 ultimatons in a typical electron. The loss of one or more ultimatons destroys typical electronic identity, thus bringing into existence one of the 10 modified forms of the electron.
Okay, so just as we saw with the 100 elements, you know, when we were imagining having the 100th element and trying to augment that, and you know, and then it goes net outward and unravels. You know, you can see the way between the lines of what they're saying there. You know, beings that can, you know, manipulate automatons, they can do this experiment. They could try to add a 101st automaton, but then it unravels. Okay. So you can't have bigger than a 100 collection, but you can have less than 100, right? There's the whole sub-electronic domain. Everything between one ultimaton and 100. So everything, you know, from 2 to 99, that region from 2 to 99 is broken into 10 groups, 10 regimes, apparently, 10 modified forms, see? So, you know, I mean, you can speculate, you know, maybe it's 2 to 10, you know, and 11 to 20, you know, et cetera, and then finally the last one is, you know, is 91 to 99. You know, maybe that's the way it does. I mean, who knows? I mean, but it's certainly suspicious that maybe it breaks on the 10 boundaries, right? I mean, there's 10 modified forms. And so you'd have, you know, 10 in all of them except the 2N, you had 9 in the 2N ones, you know, from 2 to 10 and from 91 to 99. You know, maybe. But that's as far as they, the most detail they give you about what these many phases are between the automaton and the 100. You know, is that there's at least 10 gross regimes. Who knows how much detail there is within all of that. You know, but that very fact is moving into your question, John. You know, see, the very fact that there is some integrity to something besides 1 and 100, that something could be chugging along as 20 or something and be okay with that in some sense, you know, 20 is a subset of 100. If I have a collection of 100, you know, as this thing has all of these super additive consequences, these many phases things is going to enter into that. All of that internal complexity, if you will, see, provides for all kinds of different possibilities, kaleidoscopic possibilities of intra-electronic positions. See? You know, there's 1 related to 1, but there's also like maybe 10 related to 10 and 10 related to 50. And I mean, all of this complexity. I mean, there's so that it's that internal complexity that is the sub-electronic is what gives you the diversity of the electronic level. Okay?
That makes sense.
You know, that there can be photons and electrons and neutrinos and 100 different element nuclei. And
right, all made out
all,
of 100.
All right. Out of just, you know, that 100, because it has this internal in this internal pattern that then manifests externally.
Right. And 10 differences could be 10 times 9 times, I mean, it could be so many different things, it's amazing.
Right, yeah. And there is, I mean, the number of, just the number of different isotopes. I mean, you know, I mean, you have 100 elements, but, you know, each element has many, many different isotopes. Yeah. I mean, the number is just gigantic. See, and that's just the kind of coarsest thing. You know, what about all of the details, you know, of a given isotope? And see, all that complexity, right, is bottled up in that incredible complexity of the sub-electronic, you know, subsetting of that 100 and how that would play internally. Okay, let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Yep. You something?
Sorry.
No, of course not. No, I mean, we don't even recognize the electronic level base. How could we recognize anything smaller?
So when they say modified forms, they mean?
They mean taking the 100, you know, and
there's no electronic level expression of that.
No. Well, I mean, not directly, but obviously if I have sub-electronic things in association with an electronic thing, there could be an expression, right? But not in and of itself. A collection of 10 automatons zooming around this room doesn't have an electronic expression, but that collection of 10 somehow synchronized with an atom might have a manifestation in the electronic. Right. Okay.
Automatons do not describe orbits or whirl about in circuits within the electrons. But they do spread or cluster in accordance with their axial revolutionary velocities, thus determining the differential electronic dimensions. This same ultimatonic velocity of axial revolution also determines the negative or positive reactions of the several types of electronic units. The entire segregation and grouping of electronic matter, together with the electric differentiation of negative and positive bodies of energy matter, result from these various functions of the component ultimatonic interassociation.
Okay, so here's the little gem about the main knob that you're turning to produce the whole kaleidoscopic manifestation of the electronic level, from smallest to largest. Fundamentally, what's being varied is this axial revolutionary velocity. And you've got 100 of them, okay, and then all of that, you know, in a relationship we were just describing. But basically, just, you know, to start out is just at the sort of the first level of recognition, I've got a collection of 100, and they could instead of all being at speed 1, they could be at speed 2, okay? And like they're saying, the higher the velocity, that thing is going to spread. So the more the axial revolutionary velocity goes up, the bigger the spatial footprint. You know, so like if I want to get a uranium nucleus, I've got to turn the knob way up to get this big spatially manifesting phenomenon. Okay? So that's what they mean by spread or cluster. And you know, if you dial them down, then you know, so as you go from element 100 down to element 1, if you're dialing those down, those 100 ultimatons manifest in a smaller and smaller spatial way. They cluster, you know, because the ultimatons cluster or spread, just as you turn that knob. So I just turn that knob, and the radius of the phenomenon gets bigger and smaller. Okay, so just that, you know, thinking of just purely in a spherical fashion
of the electron itself,
of that collection of 100 ultimatons. See, again, remember,
make an electron, or a proton, or
a uranium nucleus. I mean, remember, you gotta remember the collection of 100 ultimatons makes any electronic level particle.
Right, but I mean, when you're talking about the uranium versus, versus something smaller.
Yeah.
when you're talking, what are you talking about that's actually getting bigger or because of the speed? Is it okay. The actual electron itself?
Okay. Remember, there's... Forget about the cloud of electrons, you know, in the uranium atom. Just the nucleus of the uranium atom is a collection of 100 ultimatons with a whole bunch of electronic level energy added. How did I get all of that electronic level energy? I turned up the velocity in all the axial revolutions. The more I turn it up, you know, the more electronic level phenomenon there is. And it has a complexity because of all the pattern. But see, it just... When I bounce, you know, uranium nuclei off of each other, I can tell they're bigger than hydrogen nuclei, right? Their spatial footprint is bigger. Like we said at the beginning, I mean, definitely the mass of uranium is greater than the mass of hydrogen.
But modern science says they're bigger because there's more protons.
Right, they say there's a bigger pile of billiard balls, right, so it's bigger, yeah. And all the billiard balls are the same size, and so the more of them you have, the bigger the collection. Yeah, right.
You're saying something different.
No, what we're saying is, you know, the same thing that gives it more mass. See, you're adding more and more motion to it,
velocity,
which gives it more. You know, it's that rooted in that velocity. You turn up those velocities, that gives it more mass. That also gives it a bigger spatial footprint. The bigger the mass, the bigger the spatial footprint. Like we said at the very first paragraph, the two are going hand in hand. You know, a proton has more mass than an electron. Okay, so the proton better have a bigger radius than the electron, or it's not logical. Okay. You know, and a uranium nucleus better have a bigger radius than a helium nucleus, or it's not logical because it has more mass. So it's got to have a bigger radius. It's got to have a bigger spatial footprint. Because they're this one and the same thing. It's two different properties of the same fact.
Those beefy protons are wielding a big cloud.
Right, they wield a big cloud of electrons. Yeah. Right? Now, that's a separate issue, and we'll get to that in a little bit here. But,
are all the axial rates of revolution of the automatons the same within a collection?
Okay, I'm a master of... okay, for those on the webinar, he's asked me, so are all the axial revolutions of the 100 the same? I mean, how do I know? I mean, how far am I from an automatonic physics? I'm barely beginning to figure out the electronic level, these patterns that they produce. You know, this pattern is an electron. This pattern, you know, is a proton. I mean, I'm beginning to figure out those electronic level patterns, but how those patterns are generated, I don't have the slightest idea.
So what you're saying is you haven't found any clues that say it's illogical.
I mean, again, just the whole fact that I shouldn't think of them as in positions. So, like, if I think of them as little tops, you know, it's like, well, their spins, you know, parallel or anti-parallel. I mean, that's not even an appropriate thing to think because they aren't in positions, okay? And as I said at the beginning there, they're not even in orbits. So you don't want to think of that collection of 100 as having a nucleus and then things are in orbit about a nucleus. And not even they're not even in whirls. So you can't even think of it without a nucleus and just all of them going in various circles, you know, in some giant hodgepodge. It's not even that. There is no simple finite thing like that going on. You know, not positions, you know, not orbits, not circuits, you know, not anything like that. So it's way beyond anything I can comprehend right now, exactly what's going on there. But I, you know, I can take the clues that they tell me about how that complex thing begins to manifest in the finite, that there's a fundamental threefoldness that they tell you at the beginning of the next section. There's a fundamental twofoldness that they tell you various points in the book, you know, and out here systems are dual, they're triune in the central universe, right? So if you construct a basic thing that is quantized, it has a duality and a threefoldness, both, and then just look at all the, you know, I could have one unit here, I could have two units here, and just look at all the different possible patterns. You begin to notice, oh, that one, that pattern must be an electron, and that pattern must be a proton, and that pattern must be a helium nucleus, and that pattern must be a neutrino, and right? You just itemize all of the patterns, and that's a more fundamental starting point than we have right now. But obviously, eventually, you'll be able to derive those patterns from first principles when you know automatonic physics. But, you know, that's too much to do right now. All right. So that's the basic thing. And like I said, when you start looking at, you know, the patterns, you know, there's certain kinds of motions that basically contribute to the mass. There's another kind of motion that gives what we call charge.
Interesting.
Okay? Right? And you can see that in the patterns. Okay, and that's what they're talking about here. See, all of it, whether or not it's a unit of motion that is mass-like or a unit of motion that's charge-like, it's all being generated by the axial revolutions. Okay, and so to get more charge, you've got to spin up the velocities. And then you just add in the fact that it's not just some amorphous, spherically symmetric thing. There's all of this three-dimensional geometry going on, and it can be kind of a spherical net phenomenon. It can be not so spherical. It can be very kind of asymmetric, you know, a lot more in this area than in the other areas. You know, and sure enough, those that are really lopsided like that are unstable, and they readjust themselves to get more symmetric. And that's beta decay, that basic decay that takes an atom and an isotope and gets it to a stable one. Right? It's so all of that stuff, that's what they're talking about. All of the mass and charge phenomenon, you know, along with just the basic size of the particle, all has to do with dialing up and down these axial revolutionary velocities. Yeah. You know, and you dial them up like this and it kind of goes squirting out oblong like that, you know. You dial them all up just so and it kind of goes up in a symmetric fashion. You know, but it gets bigger and smaller. You know, and more or less football.
To your question, if they weren't all the same, you'd have a lot more variety within that 100 to do all the things you're trying to do with this. You probably have differential set up by differential velocities. Yeah.
Right.
It's crazy physics.
Right. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, just, now you'd start with this, you know, assumption that sort of every kind of knob that you could think of turning is turning, and then you would maybe eventually conclude that, oh, it never, that actually is not a possibility. You know, those two have to be synchronized or something. This is something you discover at the electronic level. Some things, some elements are independent, others are coupled. The charge involves a coupled phenomenon. The mass is more of an independent thing. These are things that you figure out by just working with the patterns.
Do you believe that these these axial revolution velocities, uh-huh, are quantized?
Yeah, they have to be. Yeah. Yeah, all the axial revolutionary velocities have to be quantized. Everything's quantized. You know, and that's why when it manifests in some net electronic level super summative way, you know, it's one unit or two units or three units, and you know, there's no, you know, in between.
Is all of that based on purpose?
Right, and then I see eventually, once you have a full ultimatonic physics, you could begin to contemplate the purpose that's recognizable in your complete understanding of the whole picture. You know, you could begin to appreciate, like I was saying last time, how, you know, because if you turn the force charge around, you have the thought adjusters, you have the father fragments, that they're one and the same thing. You know, that which plays inside of a father fragment is that which plays outside on top of the force charge, you know, including all the way to this stuff. Right, so you could begin to see a very transcendent purposing, you know, that the only way for a father fragment to be able to help you to get from a fifth stage spirit to a sixth stage spirit, that the reciprocal expression of that has something to do with, you know, with these intra-electronic positions. You know, it's all the same thing somehow, right? You could begin to appreciate that. All right. So that, like I said, you know, the definitive thing they're trying to lay out is, doesn't matter if you're talking about mass or charge, it all has to do with these units of motion. And then they say the entire segregation and grouping of electronic matter, see that, you know, a little ways into that paragraph. Right, so segregation, the fact that you have all these different types of electronic level particles, you know, there's gazillions of them. And grouping. They not only are separate, but they come together in groups. Like there's some that are called leptons. There's some that are called mesons. There's some that are called baryons, you know, et cetera. You know, so they come in groups. Okay. Yep, the question?
Marge says, someone told me an asymmetrical shape, for example, ellipse, is more dynamic than a symmetrical circle. Is my friend correct?
Well, again, I mean, you can have ellipses and circles, you know, if you want to kind of think like that, but it's just, there's going to come a point when a certain ellipse is too elliptical compared to the other circuits involved, you know, and so there's it's a non sequitur, and the thing's not going to be stable, you know. So, you know, that's what you're supposed to be thinking. Don't just think everything in circles. We're not talking about the dogma of the circle here. You can have an elliptical thing that you're picturing within this, but it just has to all balance in some way. And if some part of it gets too elliptical, you know, where everything is, you know, not like that, it's likely not going to be stable. Yeah. But one thing definitely about going from an even-numbered element know, atomic number 2, 4, 6, 8, et cetera, compared to atomic number 1, 3, 5. The even number elements are more symmetric than the odd atomic number ones. And so there's an example where you definitely have, it's not as symmetric as an even one, but it's stable. Right? But one of those odd numbered ones, you know, if it's too asymmetric, then it's not stable. Just like one of the even number ones, if it's too asymmetric, it's not stable.
Yeah. Well, think in terms of symmetry.
Right. Think about some beautiful complex symmetry. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Okay. Now, I'm going to have to read the next paragraph myself because I'm pretty sure I'm the only one in the room that doesn't have an altered paragraph. This paragraph got altered after the first printing, unfortunately. Okay, and everyone has, if you don't have a first printing, you have a corrupted paragraph. Okay, before we get into the details, you have two paragraphs left. It's the usual pattern. The first one is giving you the very definitive revelatory content. The second one is striking step with what we know right now and tweaking it a little bit. It's the same old pattern they do all the time. Okay? So of all the paragraphs in the book, to be, you know, this paragraph is the most corrupted paragraph in the book. See, and it is the revelatory paragraph. The corruption is to take the revelation out of it and turn it into the billiard ball model. That's what people have done to the paragraph. They've looked at it, they've noticed it doesn't match the billiard ball model, so they changed it until it matched the billiard ball model. Okay, so it's a very unfortunate change.
Do you have a first printing?
Yeah, no, this is a copy of the first printing. Yeah, that's in my lap here.
But he has a first printing too.
Yeah. Okay, so let me read into it, and we don't want to fixate on that change, because the content is very, very important. So let's make sure we have time for the actual content here.
You want to tell us what the change is?
Yeah, I'll tell you in context. You know, I mean, as we get to them, I'll point them out. Okay, so it starts out that first clause there. Each atom is a trifle over 1/100,000,000th of an inch in diameter. Okay, now, I told you this is all very profoundly revelatory. So if you look at that and you go, well, okay, let me do a little bit of calculating here. Okay, I get a number that basically is in the ballpark of the kind of so-called atomic radii, or diameters that I see scientists talking about. Is that the whole point of that statement? To just highlight that sure enough, you know how to use a ruler. Not too likely. I mean, yes, it validates it as we've tried to figure out their sizes. We're in the right ballpark. But what would they be trying to do? Okay, now they say each atom is a trifle, blah, blah, blah. Okay, does that mean every atom is the same size? No, I mean, they were just telling us that, these things get bigger and smaller, and look at the end of that sentence, the smallest atom, hydrogen. I mean, just that's telling you that there's, small and big. Okay, so it can't be that every atom is the same size. So if they're just giving me one measurement and they have and there's a range of sizes, what are they probably doing? They're probably giving me the average. Right? They're probably saying you've got a range of atomic sizes. And the average is here.
Not the mean, the average.
Yeah, the mean, yeah, whatever.
so small.
Okay. So you start to play with this, and see, and they've given you, they can't give you it exactly. They give you this 1/100,000,000th, and then they say trifle. So you calculate exactly 1/100,000,000th of an inch, and then and you're sitting, you reflect on it, and you notice, wait a minute, just a trifle away from that, I would get something that's 2.5 times what's called the Bohr radius, which is basically in the old billiard ball Bohr model of the atom. Now, that's what you think the, is the radius of the orbit of the electron around the proton in hydrogen. It's a fundamental size related to atoms. 2.5 times that that radius, that fundamental radius. Huh. Well, if there was sort of 1, 2, 3, and 4 sized ones, the average would be 1 + 4 = 5 / 2 = 5.5, 2.5. I wonder if they're telling me that there's basically four groupings of sizes. Four different levels of sizes. Yeah, that's what they're trying to hint at. And in the next section, they bring up an aspect of that, how there's four different regimes. So I'm pretty sure the proper interpretation of that is that the average is 2.5, and it goes from 1 to 4, basically. So you've got that kind of range in sizes, an average of 2.5 times that fundamental size. Okay, and then it goes on. While an electron weighs, and yours will say a little more.
Well, mine says less.
It should say a little less. Okay.
Mine says more.
Okay.
Okay.
More is less.
Okay, so. The standardized reference text says more.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So they tell you they changed it.
And they changed it in the second printing. Okay. And the reason is they're thinking in the billiard ball model. In the billiard ball model, it would have to be more, not less, because of the following. Okay, now the first thing to notice is that it should say a little less than 1/2000th of the smallest atom, hydrogen. Okay, it doesn't say 1/2000th of the proton. It says an atom. Okay. And, but everyone goes, well, a hydrogen atom is a proton and electron in the billiard ball model. The additional weight of the electron is small compared to the proton. So basically, this is apparently telling me that it's about 1/2000th relative to a proton. And you go, well, what is it exactly? Well, it's for a proton, it's 1,836. Okay. So, think about that, 1836 compared to 2,000. See, I would have to say more, not less, if it's precisely 1836 and just approximately 2,000.
It would be less, wouldn't it?
Decrease the denominator of 1/2000. If I decrease 2000 to 1836, the ratio increases, right? See, so it would be a little, it would be a little more than 1/2000 because 1/1836 is more than 1/2000. Okay, that's why it's being changed. That's why it's been changed. Okay. It's supposed to be less than.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so why? Because it's not a billiard ball hydrogen atom. Okay. Fundamentally, what you have is you don't just have a proton and an electron. When that electron comes into association with a proton, there isn't a vacuum between the proton and the electron. In the first half of the sentence, they reminded you of the size of the atom, the big distance between the proton and the electron. You know, in this case, the hydrogen atom, there's just those two. Okay. Is that space empty? No, that space is filled with motion phenomena, subelectronic motion phenomena. Okay, so when the electron is brought into association with the proton, it isn't just an electron in association with the proton. The electron blends into the space in between, and you basically have you have a proton with a surrounding motion phenomenon. A motion phenomenon that is going to really be the glue that's holding it together. Okay, we're going to get a few sections forward to that atomic integrity thing. They talk about a mesotron, the idea of a mesotron being the glue that's in there holding things together. Okay, and they tell you that the mesotron is instead of being 1836 times greater than the electron, like the proton is, it's a tenth of that. Okay, so in other words, 183.6 times greater than the electron. What you have there is a proton and this mesotron. Those are the two energies that you have combined there. Okay, so if I take 1836 plus, basically 184, let's round the 0.6 up, to the nearest, okay, add those two together, I get 2020. So that the, right, what they're trying to tell you here is the non-billiard ball picture. The amount of, forget about the whole billiard ball mass thing. Let's get into the motion and the energies. As a system of motion, that hydrogen atom, compared to the system of motion that is the electron, okay, the electron weighs, has an amount of inward motion a little less than 1 over 2,000. About 1% less. Because it's 1 over 2020, actually. About 1% less than. Okay, that's what they're actually trying to point to. That statement that looks so impossible that it has to be changed, okay, is the revelation. It's not a billiard ball. Okay, it's a system of motion. And we don't want to get into all the details that implies, but that's what's, you're supposed to be getting, knowing it's 2020, which is a little less than 1 over 2,000. Okay, and then they say, the positive proton, characteristic of the atomic nucleus, okay, and here's the first shades of you'll see very definitively in the next section, next time. In your billiard ball model, you're going, well, okay, the positive proton, it's, I guess you could say it's characteristic of the atomic nucleus, but why didn't you just say that, it is the nucleus of the hydrogen atom, because, a helium is two protons and two neutrons, so characteristic is not really, okay. Here they're using the word proton in their generalized sense, the literal meaning of the word applied to this circumstance. It's the principal individuation of the atom. The root of proton is first. The word first, okay? You have all of the non-principal individuations of the atom, the electrons. Then there's the principal individuation, the particle in the center, the single particle, not a collection of particles, a single particle, okay? And right away you can begin to see shades of that. The next thing they say, so about this central particle, for instance, they say, while it may be no larger than a negative electron, you're going, well, wait a minute. I mean, the smallest atom is hydrogen 1, and And that's basically like a proton in the center. A proton is a lot bigger than an electron. We were just talking about that, because it's a lot more massive. They're referring to, while it may be positronium. An example of a system like this is if the central particle is an anti-electron, a positron. We study this atom. The central particle is a positive electron, you know, and then there's the electron in association with it. It's called positronium. That's what they're alluding to there. I mean, that central particle may be the same size as an electron because it's a positron. It's an anti-electron.
So we haven't gotten there yet in our scientific...
No, we have gotten there. Yeah. You can look up the Wikipedia page on positronium, what they're alluding to there.
And this was printed, though.
We weren't, you know, in that mode when this was printed, yeah. But
it's rather generalized.
Right. But the thing is, back when this was printed, we thought that the electron was massively bigger in radius than the proton, too. Okay. So you see, I mean, it doesn't corrupt where people were back then. You know, they would go, okay, yeah, right. An electron is a pretty big particle. You know, it's 1,836 times bigger than the proton. That's what we thought, okay, back when we were trying to rationalize it first. But that's what they're actually referring to. But then the main point is not exotic things like positronium, but when you actually have something like a hydrogen, okay, and that's what the rest of the statement's about. Okay, it should say weighs from 2,000 to 3,000 times more. Yours may say weighs almost 2,000 times more. Okay, again, to rationalize it to the billiard ball model, it should say weighs from 2,000 to 3,000 times more. Okay. Instead of almost two, it should say from 2 to 3.
Almost true.
No.
Okay. Okay. So now what the deal is there? I mean, in obvious, you know, they're just trying to make it the same. You know, they have to change it because it's, you know, it's actually less than 2,000. It's 1,836, and so that's why they changed it to almost two. See, okay. But okay, what's actually going on? Okay, you know that the foundational fact we just considered, it's at 2020, right? The proton and the single mesotron, that's the ground state phenomenon. There's a whole range, though, of higher energy states that we do study that range up from 2 to 3. That's what they're referring to there. Is these excited states, we call them excited states of the nucleons. But see, they're talking about how much of this mesotron-like energy, you know, you're augmenting up until it unravels. You know, in just the basic one where, you know, you're just starting with the hydrogen. So just starting with what's basically, you know, what we think of as a proton and adding this mesotronic-like energy to it, you can add, you know, a certain amount, and then it's going to unravel. Okay? And so that's why it's a range. It starts at 2 because 2020 is, you know, in between 2 and 3, I mean, 2,000 and 3,000, and then goes up, you know, towards 3. So that's what the whole point of the paragraph is to remind you of the space between the electrons and the nucleus. And remember how they told you it's not empty. It's filled with all kinds of activity. It's full of all kinds of wave activity. And it's filled with particle-like activity, too, that can be rationalized initially with the idea of mesotrons. And we'll get to that later, you know, when we get to that section. Okay. But see, the whole point is to get you to think about that, and this has really huge consequences, again, for better understanding things that we observe about this. You know, that this is what's actually going on. You have this augmented nucleus, you know, that it's the space in between the electrons and the nucleus is an augmentation of the nucleus rather than empty space. Okay, and it's augmented in this unit-wise fashion, quote-unquote, as mesotrons. Okay. And that phenomenon, you know, of a mesotron, like we'll get to that when we get to that section, if it's free and unattached, you know, remember how we talk about free and unattached, okay, then it's it's called a pion. You know, but in there, it's not adding mass. It's just adding energy. See, to think of having a mesotron in there, I'm not adding more mass, but I'm adding more energy. So I said like we're comparing. See, that's why it's 2020 and not 1836. Or 1836 plus a whole bunch of mass, you know, right? I mean, it's just the energy that you're adding. That's the whole point. They're trying to get you to think in terms of that. You know, it's like, well, we've studied a hydrogen atom. There's no other billiard ball in there called a mesotron, you know, or something. I mean, that's because it's not a billiard ball. It's not a mass. It's a system of motion, okay, that's synchronized with the nucleus. And it has excited states, if you will, in the 2 to 3 range.
It's not just in the hydrogen atom either, right?
Right, and then you have, yeah, it would be with everything else too. But they're just starting, you know, with the foundational one as the example here, see. Just to get you, you know, in, you know, into the right mode of interpreting it. See, and the very fact that your preconceived opinion, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices meet that paragraph in just complete conflict. So much so that people who love the revelation just blatantly changed the words in it. You know, it was so conflicting. They couldn't countenance it. That's what you're looking for. You know you're finding revelation if you find something that's really definitively in conflict with your preconceived opinion, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. You should abide with that dissonance until you figure it out. Don't change it and relieve the tension. The billiard ball model is correct. The relators have validated it after I changed the revelation. Okay, and then it looks like a lot, but it's really just kind of a quick comment because we're not going to get into the physics of it. This final paragraph, which I'll go ahead and let you read, is taking statements out of the oft-used human source work for this, Swan's Architecture of the Universe. The part when you're going to read about the head of a pin, you know, that's taken pretty much directly. The part when they're talking about the electron, in Swan, he talks about the radius, and then he talks about the mass. Here you'll see the relators put the two together. What's literally in the human source work is all with this old false stuff about electrons being really big and all that sort of stuff. But they can cherry pick the thoughts, rearrange them, and make them true, which is what they do. And here, just read it and we'll talk about it.
If the mass of matter should be magnified until that of an electron equaled 1/10 of an ounce, then were size to be proportionately magnified, the volume of such an electron would become as large as that of the Earth. If the volume of a proton, 1,800 times as heavy as an electron, should be magnified to the size of the head of a pin, then, in comparison, a pin's head would attain a diameter equal to that of the Earth's orbit around the sun.
Okay, and again, you just wade into it and you play with it. I mean, obviously one knob I could turn is, well, exactly how big is the head of a pin? Are we talking about a millimeter diameter head of a pin? Are we talking about a 1.5 millimeter diameter head of a pin? Well, if you use one millimeter, then you'll understand why Swan used it. But if you use a 1.5 millimeter head, you play with it and you see, oh, if I interpret this properly, this is what I'm looking for. This is what gives me the relationship between the radius and the mass. So the first paragraph hints at it. The last paragraph is what gives it to you. And they give it to you in this very clever way where they found someone who put down some words that they could rearrange a little bit. Yeah, and then if you just reflect on it properly, you can get what they're suggesting. You can get this very fundamental physics equation about the relationship between the radius and the mass. And it has to do with this ratio of masses that we know very well. You notice here, proton, and then, 1,800 times as heavy as an electron. Oh, okay, now we're not talking about the smallest atom, hydrogen. Now we're just talking about literally the proton and that 1836 ratio here. Okay, because Swan was talking about the proton and the 1836 ratio. They're using that.
That's the reason why they changed it.
Right, see, and that's another reason, they go, if the second to the last, next to the last paragraph is going to agree with the last paragraph, we got to change the next to the last paragraph. It's like, no, it's talking about two different things.
They didn't get that.
Right, they missed that.
Nope.
And so, when all is said and done then with this section, they've given you a handful of initial anchor points and clues. How to approach atomic structure in a new philosophic mode. How to begin to think about it beyond the billiard ball model. The reason that you want to do that is because you're interested in more than just a rationalization scheme that gets the correct answers. If that's all you want, the billiard ball model with all the endless epicycles that humans have added to it in the last 100 years is adequate. Okay? But if you want to understand logically what's going on, and begin to eliminate some of these acausal phenomena and, and to get these ahas of recognition, it's like, oh, that's why that decay, or, quote, works like that, or that's why that mode of radioactivity works like that. As soon as you have the actual objective picture, a number of things just leap out at you. Once you start to think about that electron, when it comes into relationship with the nucleus, turning into a mesotron, basically. See, it's the electron plus the region in between, and it's acting like a mesotron. This gives us a whole new perspective on why it is a lot of times that atoms don't seem to work like collections of parts. They seem to work more like a holistic fact. See? And we'll see that some more in the next section, next time. Is there anything else that we'd like to do real quick on top of that? All right, let's leave it for at that point for the moment, and we'll go into a little bit more about atomic matter. You see next time here. Let's take a moment.